Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So a couple of days ago from us recording this podcast, I was seated on the couch watching the London Marathon, and boy oh boy did we get some amazing action at that event. And it was a race that had multiple levels of interest for me. First of all, it was watching the elite race, both the men and the women. Of course, my son was also running, and he did 3 hours 10 minutes, which I think he'd be very pleased with, and I think it was a very impressive start to his marathon career. But today we're going to be talking a little bit about more of the details regarding the winners of that event, and how the changing guard of marathon running internationally pretty much changed overnight at the London Marathon this year. So we'll get into that a little bit later. But before we get into the details of that and discuss it, let's take our eye towards the caught my eyes. And Professor Ross Tucker, as usual, here with me. Got a couple of big ones, and there's a big story brewing, of course, in the world of doping. But before we get onto that one, there's a couple of others you've been picking up on our Patreon site.
Yep, thanks. Yeah, and a couple that I saw, actually. One of them came to me via Twitter, and it was from Benji Nason, who does a lot of cycling analysis on Twitter, if you're interested. But he sent a link to an article that I wanted to talk to you about very quickly. You remember that we've discussed already this year ketones and performance, mm-hmm. and then bicarbonate and performance.
Yes. So, and Jumbo Visma's use of it.
Allegedly both. Allegedly. And the bicarb came out because that company that made the carb drink that was so heavily marketed,
Merton.
And sub 2 hour, Morton, Merton, whatever. They've now got a bicarb drink or gel sachet that uses the same technology to, in a sense, protect the bicarb from the gut. Because the problem with bicarb was always it made you throw up a lot. So even though it had these alleged buffering benefits. So,
not good for TV, throwing up.
Yeah. No, that tends not to happen on the screen. So what happened was, he shared this link, and it's quite cool because it's like one of those crossovers, you know, like when you get like a mix of two things. Because a study was published talking about the potential compounding effects of bicarbonate and ketones. It came out in 2021, actually, so it's not super recent. Title being, Bicarbonate Unlocks the Ergogenic Action of Ketone Monoester Intake in Endurance Exercise. So what they did in this study, having done some work before on ketones, they found that if you took ketones during exercise in the early part of a 3.5 hour, say, cycling race simulated in a lab, it lowered the pH in the bicarbonate without affecting performance. So they said, well, maybe these two things interact with one another. So they did a study in which they hypothesized that the acid-base disturbances called by ketones overrule the ergogenic potential of exogenous ketosis in endurance exercise. So what you get from, in other words, what they're saying there is that you might gain something from ketones, but you also lose something on the flip side of that.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, what if we combine ketones and bicarbonate? So then we cancel out the negative effect and we leave behind only the positive. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So they did this study, and admittedly, it's only on 9 cyclists. The significance of this will become clear shortly, who did a similar thing. It's a 3 hour submax intermittent cycling followed by a 15 minute time trial preceding an all-out sprint. So it's kind of like simulating what would happen in a cyclist. And in some trials, they just had ketones. In other trials, they just had bicarb. And then in the third one, they had a combination of these, all compared to a control where they just had placebo and a carbohydrate. And what they found is that when you combine them, the performance benefit is greater than when each one is taken by itself. So time to exhaustion in the sprint was similar in all conditions. Gastrointestinal conditions were similar. But they find, and I just wanted to find this significant sentence for you, additional bicarbonate resulted in a higher blood beta-hydroxybutyrate. So that's greater ketone levels during the first half and increased blood bicarbonate levels. The mean power output was similar between them, but was 5% higher in the ketone plus bicarbonate. So it seemed that the two had a benefit where the one alone did not.
Okay.
And so it's not, the reason it piqued my interest is because I remember hearing that some of the teams had been experimenting with asthma drugs and other meds. And it was one legal medication, no effect. Another one, no effect. But A plus B equals effect. And so I'd heard the teams were experimenting. And I got to thinking that I wonder whether the combined effect of ketones and bicarbonates is what's actually causing elite cyclists to find some benefit that lab studies in the past, looking at one or the other, maybe necessarily haven't found.
So you think that the elite cyclists are using that combination already?
Well, we know that, for instance, Jumbo are, because they were
early
adopters of ketones, and then presumably among other teams, they're using the bicarbonate. Remember there's that funny interview?
We don't know if they're having them together. Would you take them at the same time, or would you take them as two different?
That's what the study is suggesting, and that's what I wonder if something like that's happening. So it's kind of like, oftentimes science looks at one thing because it wants to be systematic and simple, no confounders. But sometimes the confounders are the source of the benefit. You know what I mean? And I wonder whether this is an example. I don't know what they're doing. It might be that they're not doing it this way. And again, this is only 9 people, and it was in 2021. Maybe there are studies currently on the go in larger groups and better athletes, because we've always discussed what happens in an elite cyclist is quite different from someone like us, who's very far from our ceiling compared to them. So yeah, it's an interesting one that you might be able to, you know, and we've often spoken about this. You might gain 2%, but you lose 2% from the same thing, because there are little trade-offs, and the clever combination of those things eliminates the downside and leaves only the upside behind. And that seems to be this. So the discussion, the conclusion in the abstract here is the co-ingestion of oral bicarbonates and ketones enhances high-intensity exercise performance at the end of an endurance exercise event without causing gastrointestinal distress.
We don't know what the levels of that ingestion is, do we? I mean, they don't sort of mention how much bicarb there is, how much ketones.
No, they do. They do. 65 grams of ketone, 300 milligrams per kilogram body weight bicarb, which is a lot.
That was always the
problem with the bicarb, was to get the benefit, you had to take so much that you're almost guaranteed to be ill. Mm. In this study, they're saying there was no gastrointestinal distress. And so, and that's the promise Morton has made with respect to that technology as well. So having set that up, then what happened is Renato Canova, who's a regular and patron, sent me a link in which Inigo San Milan, who you'll know is the coach of Pogacar, right?
Yep.
The headline of this article is, if it improved performance, it would cure cancer. Pogacar coach debunks bicarb benefits. So this guy's come out and says, like many supplements that don't work, they tend to resurface 20 to 30 years later. And he's absolutely said, like, that these things won't make any difference. The article goes on to talk about the bicarbonate hit headlines when it was linked to Jumbo-Visma's run of success. And then it mentions the new product from Morton. And then San Milan has gone a step further and said that bicarb per se, he says bicarb is one of the oldest supplements out there. It's been used for decades. Like many supplements that don't work, they tend to resurface 20 to 30 years later. And then he goes on to explain why he doesn't believe it can have an effect, because he's saying that that blood pH is so tightly regulated that, and there's already enough bicarbonate in the system, that when you add more, you're not really giving the body any capacity to change any more than it already could have done, you know? And he talks about our body having this large pool of bicarb, and that the pH in the muscle can drop because of the acidosis of exercise, but the bicarb in the blood doesn't reach that muscle in order to neutralize that. So, and when you read the studies, they measure the bicarb level in the blood. And that's the study I just read, for instance, does that. So he's absolutely certain that this thing wouldn't make a difference. He reckons if it could get into the cells in this way, it would be beneficial for cancer, because apparently one of the things cancer does is it lowers the pH of the cells. So, there you go. So whether this is part of the fog of war in the peloton, I don't know, but there you go.
I'm sure some supplement company will be looking at that and saying, well, I'm sure we can create some marketing speak around this and sell a lot of products as a result of this, whether it works or not.
Extra penetrable bicarb that gets into the ours gets into the muscle, theirs doesn't, or something.
Yeah.
But it's funny, though, because I always thought bicarb did work, and the only reason it wasn't more widely used was because of that unpleasant side effect of gastrointestinal and vomiting and nausea.
Is that when people take Rennie's, for instance? I think Rennie's is a globally relevant and acid for the stomach. I mean, that's a sort of bicarb, isn't it?
Yeah, but the thing is, like, and we spoke about it when we discussed the bicarb, you have to take so much of it, like 300 milligrams. In that study, for instance, 300 milligrams per kilogram body weight is a ton of bicarb. Mm. I mean, that's like all the Rennies you've got.
Make a cake with that. Yeah.
It's like so much that actually it would be impossible to consume. So, yeah, people do use the Rennies, but this is like now a mega dose, right?
People swear by Rennies. I mean, I know lots of people who...
Yeah, but even for cramps and things like that. And, But I'd seen so many studies saying that there's a benefit in high-performance, high-intensity sprint exercise. Mm. But it causes all these... Morton thought that they'd solved... By.
Yeah, Jumbo not doing so well this year and Pogacar and UAE doing well this year.
But just, it's funny, like we say, they're not doing so well. But up until Flanders, they'd won everything.
Yeah, fair enough.
So, and multiple stage races. So, anyways, it was interesting to see those two things side by side.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, thanks, Renato, for sending that.
Nice one.
Couple other ones that came in. Pratima, another regular and patron, thanks very much, sent us a link to an article that is on a website called My Sport Science, which is maybe well known to some of you. It's run by Asker Jurkendrup, whose name is known, especially in the world of nutrition and carbs and supplements, one of the leading researchers in the space. This is an article titled No Evidence to Adapt Training to the Phase of the Menstrual Cycle. And I've told Pratima that we've had it on our agenda for a long time to get someone in to talk about this, because I don't know anything like enough to trust myself to explain these issues. Mm. So that we do have that, and I've committed to it. So now I'm committing to everyone in the same way. But basically, Asker talks about a study, a review that's just come out led by Lauren Colenso-Semple and Stuart Phillips, in which they've reviewed the evidence for claims that women must adapt training because the menstrual cycle might affect their response, in this instance, to strength training. It's often argued that the menstrual cycle, in which stage you're in, might either dampen or amplify what you get as an adaptation to strength training. Mm. And I'll jump straight to the conclusion of the paper in the author's words. When reviewing the evidence as a whole and the methodological shortcomings therein, we propose it is highly premature to conclude that short-term fluctuations in ovarian hormones influence acute exercise performance or even long-term adaptations to resistance training. Therefore, the development of resistance exercise training prescriptions based on cyclical hormonal changes is not an evidence-based approach. So that's pretty strong at this stage for saying that right now, there is no basis on which you would change how women do resistance training compared to men because of the menstrual cycle, which is interesting because it's widely known and there's no doubt that women's physiology is massively under-researched in terms of injury, performance, and specifically how the menstrual cycle affects those things. You know, I don't know if you've heard that menstrual function is linked to the risk of severe knee injuries, ACL injuries. But the evidence on it is all a little bit sketchy because they're so rare. Like an ACL injury is like one or two a season in a tournament, you know, if that. So drawing conclusive links between menstrual function and injury and menstrual function performance is quite difficult. So what this paper has said is that at this point there's no evidence for it. Now, that doesn't mean that we should take away that they are the same. It just means that it's not yet known and there's no evidence on which to do it. And the reason I think it's interesting is even in the rugby world where I'm in now, one of World Rugby's six pillars of growth, its strategy, is women's rugby and particularly player welfare and health. So we have a women's rugby research group. We have a women's concussion working group. We've got all sorts of research studies dedicated to women's player welfare, concussion, injury, and so on. And there's this real push that we have to like reinvent everything for women's player welfare. And I actually think you're probably better off assuming that 90% of us of it is the same. In other words, there's more similarity than there is difference. Mm. And if you don't understand that, then you're going to go back to the drawing board. And you don't actually have to do that. You'd rather want to build on what we already know. And then that 10% is really important. But you don't have to do from 0 to 100. We actually have to get from 90 to 100. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's interesting that there's no evidence at this point for this. So now the question is, will be, well, can we find that evidence in better studies, yes or no? And then maybe this thing gets updated in a couple of years. So, yeah, interesting that Pratima, because I have a very strong suspicion that if we spoke to an expert now, other than the experts who wrote this paper, we'd probably be told that women should change their training based on menstrual function.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the prevailing thought.
Yeah, it almost makes sense, doesn't
it? This review argues that right now you're guessing. There's no evidence on which you would base those decisions, which is interesting. Yeah,
fascinating one, that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And then just a couple other things, just two more sort of very brief comments. I don't know if you remember a while back, we were talking about a young golfer who did golf balls into a washing machine.
Yes.
You brought it up.
It was Tiger Woods that did that.
It was, in fact, Rory McIlroy.
Oh, it's Rory McIlroy. You're right.
I only know that because Peter Lowry sent us a message saying he actually sent us something
quite
else,
right,
a longer comment, and he said, by the way, I'll just tell Mike it's actually Rory McIlroy.
That's so correct. I've seen the footage. You're 100% correct.
There you go.
Yes, thank you for that.
Last one, I was just reminded by Robert Hilliard. We do these Caught My Eyes at the start of each show because we want to acknowledge the patron support and the dialogue that they give us. One of them, Travis Hawkins, is going to come up in a moment because he gave me so much cool stuff to read on our next topic. But Robert said, you know, he wants to know where the main topic is. So those of you who listen to our show and want to jump straight to the main topic, Mike is now putting the time that the main topic starts in the show notes. So if you just scroll down, you'll see something saying skip to 35:12 for the main topic. So, yeah, that's to save you the hassle of having to skip, and
correct,
then go back and forth. So thanks, Robert, for reminding me of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, just thanks to all the rest of you for your comments. There's a couple of others. Ian and Paulie B got in touch with a model for anti-doping from the world of mixed martial arts. It's a nice article from the BBC, but I'm going to park that until our next show, and then we can go into that in some more detail. And that is it from the world of patron for this week. The next Caught My Eye is actually yours.
Yeah, so this came up through multiple different sources, some of them on Instagram, one or two people who messaged me and sort of explained that there was this big story brewing. And it comes from the world of long-distance triathlon, and it's the story of American Colin Chartier, who was caught with EPO and given a three-year ban. And you kind of say, well, we've had that before when we've seen in athletics and that sort of thing, but what makes this case different? Well, first of all, he's a very high-profile American triathlete, and it really did rock the world of triathlon, and many triathletes that I follow on Instagram reacted to it in some shape or form. And he's completely taken responsibility for it to some extent. We'll discuss to what extent he did do that. He's been on a podcast, which will play you some of those clips just now. But he really does come out. He admits he did it. He then talks a little bit about why he did it and the process of doing it. So he kind of comes clean more than I've seen many other sports people who have been caught for drugs have admitted. And we're so used to seeing sports people around the world getting caught and then they're denying it and discovering all sorts of reasons why they didn't take it or why the test is wrong. Colin Chartier takes it on the chin and completely admits that he did it and explains why he did it, and of course explains even how he got the substance that he used to take it. So it's an interesting one, but it has really hurt the world of long-distance triathlon because to some extent he's also implicated and said that the top level, it is happening and it's rife, he believes, even though he doesn't have any evidence for that.
Yeah, and you know, I hadn't heard of the guy or the case until you messaged me.
Mm.
And then coincidentally, it came up on Patreon, and it was specifically Travis Hawkins, I mentioned earlier, said, have you seen it? And if you haven't, let me send you some links. And so, of course, he did. And he sent me a couple of links to podcasts, to Twitter accounts, to Instagram posts, and so on. So then I got the crash course. It saved me a lot of time. Thanks, Travis. Really appreciate it. And yeah, you know, it reminded me quite a lot of the Zane Robertson confession, the podcast interview he did.
This is a New Zealander.
Yeah, yep. We covered that a couple of episodes back. Yeah. Difference being that this Colin Chartier guy didn't sound anything like as emotionally upset by his ban as Robertson did. But many of the elements are the same. And it's like there are recurring themes in the world of doping. Because he's very much saying, I'm a lone wolf. And in fact, the podcast that I'll provide a link to in the show notes is called How They Train. It's a podcast with a guy called Jack Kelly, and their like sort of core offering is they interview these very famous triathletes, and they talk to them about their training and their lifestyle and their nutrition and all sorts of things. It's cool insight, actually. So I gave it a listen, and I must say, Kelly asks him all the right questions. It's a good interview. He asks him at least 3 or 4 times to stand behind his assertion that he acted alone. He literally says to him, I don't think anyone's going to believe you. How can we believe that you acted alone? And every single time, Chartier says, well, I absolutely do. I looked it up on the internet myself. I bought it on the internet myself. I administered it. I spoke to nobody, not my coach, not fellow athlete, nobody, all by myself. Now, I don't know what your take is on that. I mean, I find it very difficult to believe that a person whose life is 30 hours a week worth of training and who probably is micromanaged by a team of people would not at some point confide in one of those people.
I think there's, I mean, to his, maybe to his credit here, taking that and explaining that does make sense to me, that he, you know, he sort of talks about the disappointment of the people around him in his admittance here. So there was obviously a lot of shame involved in the process and the decision to take the dope. But, you know, it does make sense to me that he potentially can hide it, and he could hide it. I mean, you could certainly get the stuff online, and we know that you can do that, and you can take it on. And who's to know the people around him, even his parents, might not know he's taking it. And it's just a shame to admit it.
In fact, one of the links Travis provided me to is in a Twitter account at Tim Hemming, journalist who covers triathlon. And Tim Hemming, latest tweet, literally 33 minutes ago, as I'm sitting here reading this to you, interesting thesis from Marymount University. Hemoglobin, hematocrit, and body composition status of collegiate triathlon and cross-country athletes during the competitive season. Guess who the student was?
Yes, I'm guessing it's our Colin Chartier.
Indeed, it was.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's really interesting. So clearly he's had some exposure to the world of blood parameters. Mm. It is possible. I remember once I was in Eugene for US Olympic trials, and I was having a drink with a guy called Dan Pfaff, who's a very famous sprints coach, and he coached Bailey among other guys, Obadeli Thompson. And I remember saying to him, like, who's the athlete you've got the most confidence in that was absolutely clean? And he said, I can't have confidence in any athlete. Mm-hmm. So even your own. He says, how? Like 15 hours a day, they're in their own home, their own bathroom, their own kitchen. I'm not there. I can't see what that athlete has done. And so it is possible for a person to go and do it themselves. I think more often than not, you wouldn't be alone.
Mm.
And then the other thing that came up again on Tim Hemming's Twitter timeline is in response to a post by Hemming, in which he again talks about Colin is the lead researcher with Dr. Michael Nordvall studying hemoglobin, hematocrit, and anthropometric alterations. He's responsible for design, collection, and statistical analysis. The first reply to that post is Steve Magnus, who's one of the famous whistleblowers against Salazar. And in the podcast with Kelly, Chartier talks about how, and it was actually really interesting, he says, I'd used gateway substances to doping before. Did you pick that up?
Mm.
He says, I'd used L-carnitine injections, which are strictly illegal, but I was using that. And then it made it easier for me to move to EPO. And Magnus picks that up and says it's almost certainly had help on some of this and isn't being transparent. He took L-carnitine injections. These have to be specially compounded by a specialty pharmacy. No way he didn't have help.
Hmm.
So there is more to this, you see, and then that's, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so two interesting things. One is Magnus's comment, and secondly is the L-carnitine. Remember, that was what Salazar was infusing in massive doses. It's allegedly what Farrow was getting from a doctor in England. And I didn't know that it was specialty made as an injection, but there you go. So maybe he had to have had some support. Mm. The other bit that, again, people are going like, come on, man. Oh, by the way, did you see Sebastian Kienle's reply to Chartier's Instagram post?
Well, obviously himself a great long-distance triathlete. I think I won Ironman.
2014 or something, yeah, I think it was, yeah, if I remember correctly. And he basically came on, again, it's covered in the podcast I'll link to. he basically came, let me guess, you did this alone, you had no support, no one else knew, it was all on you. So nobody really believes him. And when you read the comments to Chartier's Instagram confession, you'll see the same theme come up over and over. It's like, you, if you don't disclose everything, there's no forgiveness and there's no possibility of redemption for you, which is not dissimilar to the Robertson case, right?
Yeah. I suppose to some extent it's just a case of not wanting to sink their fellow competitors in their own confession.
Which brings me to the big paradox in the podcast, but I'll get there in a moment. I do think, like, I don't know when Chartier would have gotten his ban. Was it literally like a day or two ago?
Yeah, it was about a week ago from us doing the podcast, yeah.
And it was the same thing with Robertson appearing on that podcast like a day after he got the 7-year suspension. So whilst they've had notification of their positive test, the rest of the world didn't. And I think it's too early for them to fully intellectualize, internalize, and then project out what they did and what they were thinking. So with Robertson as well, like, he's too emotional at this moment to actually be asked to come clean. So, and I think it's the same. These guys need 6 months to a year, and then I think they should be asked to, like, now listen, you need to actually tell us a little bit more here.
So what would you, I'm interested to know, what you, if you wanted them to come clean, what would you want to know?
Well,
from Robertson and in this case Chartier.
Well, I would like details on if you ordered it alone, well, then, like, show us those orders. Like, so there's got to be some.
In other words, what websites did you use, and
where did you get it? What dosage did you get? How much did you pay for it? How was it received? How did you, where did you learn to do it? You know, like, because if they can explain that all, then okay, you've got a little bit of credibility in your story. But if you can't explain it all, well, then maybe I'm starting to think actually you didn't get it on the internet. I think maybe you got it from someone you knew. So I'd want to explore that and, like, look into the entourage a little bit more, you know? There's no doubt. And again, Chartier, because of that background, which I didn't realize, it's funny that he didn't bring his background and research up in the interview when he was asked to justify taking it alone. Because no one believes that a triathlete's going to just figure this out. Because he's got at least some basis to claim that, right? Because he's got this qualification studying it.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt, when you look at the Kenyans that get popped, like, they are not doing this alone. There's entourage around them, and I think that needs to be a lot tighter. The problem is that no athlete wants to be a whistleblower because there's actually no incentive for them.
No. Like, well, they get completely, I mean, from the people that they know and respect them, they're now going to get completely vilified.
Right.
So it's a double whammy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And so you've got to offer quite a large reward to overcome that double whammy. Floyd Landis, you see, didn't care. He lost all interest in being liked and popular because he was already to some degree excluded and vilified.
Now he's a cannabis farmer.
So he said, I'm just going to burn this thing down because they've locked me inside it. So I'm going to burn everything down with them as well. You know what I mean? So like, that's a different circumstance. But these guys never want to talk about the how they go about it. And for me, the most interesting thing about this Chartier interview is he's asked by Kelly why. Like, he says to him literally, no bullshit, just tell me why. And I don't know if we want to play the little clip in, but you'll hear his answer to that is quite interesting because it invites a degree of almost cognitive dissonance, in my opinion. So let's hear from him in his own voice, and then after that we'll talk about maybe what I think is the disconnect here.
Colin, answer me this with no bullshit. Why did you dope? Like, why EPO? What got you there? What got you to that ultimate point? I hear you say, like, you know, you wanted to win the big races and you felt pressure, but I just don't feel like you're telling me everything. Like, tell me everything. Why?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I felt this pressure or believed this, but I really wanted to win this year and beat the best in the sport. And at the end of the day, like, I don't know. I don't believe they're clean. And if I'm going to try to win, like, there's no amount of self-belief I can have in myself if I believe the top guys are doping. And I think it's sad that I came to this decision. And I don't have any evidence that top guys are. It's just the belief I had, and that's what ultimately led me to choosing to dope.
Yeah, so kind of almost a sad resignation for him, sort of saying, well, I had to do it to be competitive, because he believes that everybody is taking performance-enhancing drugs.
Which is almost exactly, you remember what Zane Robinson said? And I think I'm quoting from his interview exactly. He said, I was tired of getting my ass kicked every week by guys I knew were doping, so therefore I doped. So that's what they feel, right? Now, what's interesting there is, he says, I believed they were doping. And of course the answer to this is yes, but it's amazing to think that a guy who has come, and this is the other bit that I think most people are being almost incredulous and aggressive towards him about, is he won a massive race in September, was it? $100,000 prize, US Open, I think it was. And then he says he only started doping a month or two after that. And people are saying, come on, man, pull the other one. That's not on. It's for a top guy to start doing something that he must realize carries with it so much risk, and that he's taking on himself, and he knows is wrong, based only on suspicion, doesn't seem to me to be all that believable. I think he knows that there's doping. It's not suspicion. He's watered it down.
Well, he's obviously convinced that there is doping.
Exactly. He's not just. I think they might be. I better do it too. He's like, I know. And therefore, I believe it. So he's going to do it. And he kind of doubles down on that later on. Kelly, once again, gives him an opportunity to talk about it. And you'll hear it now again. He goes into it in even more detail. But again, listen to how he wants to soften it. I have no evidence. I don't know this for sure. He's evasive about why he did it and what his process was by which he created this belief. This, as you say, convinced himself that they were doping based on what, Lance Armstrong? He literally talks like that.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
It's just soft, you know? It comes across quite soft to me.
Well, let's listen to that second bit, because he talks specifically and gets asked the question whether or not he knows of any athletes that have taken performance-enhancing drugs. And again, a very tragic answer.
Colin, you said that the Norwegians, Mikael Eden, your coach, Gustav Eden, Christian Blumenfeld, by association, I guess the other coaches in their group, like Olav Alexander Bu, you've said definitively they were not involved. They have no knowledge of it. I like to believe that they themselves are clean. Not just speaking about them, Colin, have you ever had any conversations with other professional triathletes that you've trained with or talked to, either in person or over the phone or on social media, about their drug use? Do you know of any other professional triathletes in the sport that are currently or have in the past taken performance-enhancing drugs?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't had any personal conversations with other athletes in the sport about this. High performance sport across all bodies, like, there is incredible suspicion. And as you know, as much as I want to believe all the competitors are clean, I also hold the idea that there's suspicion. And it's hard to hold both of those together because they're contradictory. And I don't know, at the end, if I didn't, you know, have suspicions that other athletes were doing it, I would have been less likely to do it. And then you just look at the history of sport in the last 20 years and cycling and lands, all these other sports, it's difficult to believe in sport. And I know, and I really wish that sport was something that was clean and fun and pure, because that is what sport should be, to be doing it out of pure joy and together with other athletes. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, we live in a broken world. And I'm sorry I added to that.
Okay, so now let's say you're in the interview seat now, interviewer seat, the journalist. Mm-hmm. What's the follow-up question to that, in your opinion?
Well, I suppose you do want to know the details.
Yeah, exactly.
And again, he's not incentivized to share the details, even if he does know them.
Yeah.
And having spoken to a couple of elite athletes in my time over the years, and those that are on the cusp of being professional and good professional, and those kind of sitting in that sort of end zone, you hear the dilemma of those athletes, because I still believe that there are seriously great athletes out there that are not taking performance enhancing drugs, but there are so many that believe that in order to get to the top you have to do it. And unfortunately, it's that second tier that are young and rising through the ranks and getting there and believing that unless they do it, they're not going to get there. And it's this fight, I guess, between an acceptance. And I know, for instance, because a family member very close to me who was a professional triathlete gave up the sport because one of his heroes that he was training with at the time that he was at his peak, he discovered that one of his heroes was taking performance enhancing drugs just by the, you know, just casually mentioned it. And that was the end of his triathlon career, purely because he got so demoralized by the fact that he knew that he wasn't going to be at the top level.
Unless he did the same, right?
Yes, yeah. He kind of believed that.
So that's clearly the dilemma. And when we posted the Zane Robertson podcast interview, a lot of people came and said there was a split, some sympathetic, some very unsympathetic towards him. And I get that you don't want to be sympathetic towards a doper, but if you don't recognize that is a real dilemma for these guys and women who do these sports, then I don't know that you'll ever solve the problem. You have to recognize it. Even if you don't agree with it, it's there. It's still, it's reality. For them, it's reality. So until you can address that. But the thing I would challenge him on now is on other occasions in that interview, he spoke about you could test him in the past. He said, you can trust that I was clean before November. It was only after that. So he's very willing and fast to rely on the testing procedures to clear himself in the past. But at the same time, he knows by his own telling that all these athletes are doping. And how many positives has triathlon had? Well, none. That's why this is such a big story. He's the first big name triathlete to get done this way. So he almost reveals a double standard, I think, a little bit. He wants testing to exonerate him, but it hasn't exonerated anyone else that he knows is doping. So what are we to take away from that with regards to the quality of testing?
Yeah.
I would say he's either absolutely incorrect that other athletes are doping, which I don't think is the case, or we just have to recognize that other athletes are doping and getting away with it, which means he might have been too. So he's in a bit of a bind there. And then I think the other area that I think is a little bit inconsistent is I think it's probably, it's almost certainly true. He won't have evidence of other athletes doping, but he's got more than just, I've seen it in cycling and Lance to base his belief on, right? That's what we were saying earlier is he's seen unusual performance improvements in colleagues and rivals, competitors. He's seen training sessions by people that he's working with. He's heard conversations over dinner like you mentioned your family member had heard. And so he knows more than just the regular fan knows. The athletes know who's dodgy and who's not. Yeah. I mean, I've heard as well, like guys who say, you knew he was doping 6 months before he got caught. Mm. So they know. But until he's willing to tell how he knew and who he knew about, I don't think anyone's going to believe anything else he says.
No.
You need to come completely clean or not at all.
Yeah.
He seems to me to be wanting to have it halfway. Well, I'm walking away now.
I guess I'm less cynical about him. I do feel, as I did with Robertson, feeling a little bit, you know, sympathetic towards their cause, even though it's not forgivable. It's certainly, as you just said, you have to understand the pressure that these guys are under. And I often take the example of an athlete where many of these athletes grow up at school level and better, and sometimes in countries where socioeconomically this is also an incentive, where the only thing you have is the sport that you're participating in. It's the only thing you're good at. It's the only thing you potentially can make money out of. And suddenly somebody says to you, well, unless you're doping, you're not going to win any money and make a living and put food on the table. That's an incentive to say, well, I need to push the limits here as much as I can, because it is no longer a fair slate here for anybody.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And remember, on the Robertson podcast, I think we agreed, look, we are enormously sympathetic to that dilemma.
Yeah.
And one can point to your family member who said, no, I'm walking away, or to Christophe Moreau.
It wasn't an easy decision, I can tell you.
Remember Lance spoke about that French cyclist who the peloton called Mr. Clean, because he was the only guy in the peloton who wasn't taking stuff. And eventually he got almost forced into retirement by the speed of the race. He was just getting battered off the back every race. Moreau, I think it was, right?
Mm.
There are guys who say, no, I will not do this. But most of them, at the age of, I don't know what this Colin guy is, but in their mid to late 20s, early 30s, there's no fallback plan. So they proceed because they feel it's necessary to proceed. Mm. So I'm not talking about that per se. I'm talking more about after the fact. Are you willing to now come clean and try and explain exactly what it's like in that world? And again, I know why they don't do it, because A, they're scared, and B, they're trying to be decent.
Mm.
Like, why should I sink everyone we were all in the same predicament. This unbelievable, like, catch 22, Hobson's choice material. So I'm not going to talk. But that's the thing that will get them forgiveness, as it were, from the community, is if they did it.
Yeah.
But he'd be sued.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't have evidence. So if he says, you know, I was really suspicious of some of those Norwegians, he's a goner financially.
For sure. Yeah.
So the system has to try and protect him against that, but still figure out what he knows.
Yeah.
That's the key.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let us know what you think about this particular story. If you're involved in the world of triathlon, I'm sure it is a big story. And well, as we have discovered, it is a big story in many ways, not just in the world of triathlon. So that is the story of Colin Chartier.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Right, so enough of the bad news. Let's focus on some of the more extraordinary performances, and as we alluded to at the start of the podcast, this last weekend from us recording today, we watched the London Marathon, the TCS London Marathon, and lots of things to be excited about. And what happened there was not what I expected to happen, because we don't necessarily think of London as the sort of Berlin World Marathon course in terms of times, but it certainly produced the most amazing result in Calvin Kiptum, who for the second year in a row won the London Marathon in the second fastest time ever for a marathon distance, and just outside the record of Eliud Kipchoge. And I must be honest, I never heard about this guy until I was doing the research around London Marathon and watching it before the race, because he's, you know, he's a relatively newcomer. But the second fastest marathon, 2:01:25, 17 seconds away from Kipchoge's world record, and that included a negative split of 59:45. So in other words, he ran the second half of that race in 59 minutes and 45 seconds, which is just absolutely. And I'll give you some more of the stats a bit later on, but it was one of those, and we'll talk a bit about the women's performance there as well, and talk about particularly Evans Chebet in the Boston Marathon. But just when you think that everybody's talking about Eliud Kipchoge, he doesn't perform at Boston, and then suddenly there's Eliud Kipchoge 2.0 coming out of nowhere, 23 years of age, and suddenly everybody's talking about this new guy, Calvin Kiptum.
Yeah, no one really had heard of Kiptum until about November last year. When was Valencia?
Yeah, it was late. It was late. Like it's late, it was in late year, in the
maybe
year.
Maybe in
yeah.
December.
Yeah.
And then he ran the fastest debut ever.
Yeah. Another tough one.
That was the same pattern as this, because he started relatively slowly and ran what at that stage was the fastest half of a legitimate marathon. Like, yeah. I'm not counting the gimmicks of Kipchoge now again. So he's basically repeated the same pattern twice and improved by 20 odd seconds. The debut was 2:01:53, and now it's 2:01:25. And legitimately, if he'd gone 5K earlier, he'd go under that world record, because he was running 3-4 seconds a K faster than his average pace for that surge. So again, notwithstanding the fact that he was maybe right on the limit by the end. Yeah. That world record's now well in reach. And he spoke, I saw an interview with him at the finish line saying he thinks it's a couple more years. I think it's now.
And everybody agrees with you.
It seems very clear that it's now. The only thing is, in my, not admittedly, like with this level of athlete, the world's maybe never seen this level of athlete or performance. Mm. Some guys just can't run even splits. They have to do negative splits. Mm. You know, like for them, they almost need to be conservative and then unleash something. But in my mind, if you've got the ability to run a 59:45 on the way to a 2:01:25
in the second half,
you should go out in 60:20.
Yeah.
You should go out in 60:20, 60:30, and you'll break 2:01. You should do that.
Yeah.
It's possible Kiptum can't, because for whatever reason, he just needs to hold something back and feel like he's accelerating and running faster in the second half. But in London, they went through halfway in 61:40.
Mm-hmm. Well, taking you back to that, the first 5K split was 14:30, which was 16 seconds off the same split by Kipchoge
in Berlin when he broke the world record.
So he was a relatively slow start.
Yeah, the whole first half is slow.
Yes.
Yeah. 61:40 is like nowadays it's routine.
Yes.
That men's marathon looked like it was ambling towards a typical but average finish.
Mm.
And then. Then he runs a 14:30 from 25 to 30. And then he drops a 13:49.
Yeah.
And a 14:01. I mean, it's unbelievable, maybe, literally. Mm. And then closes in 2:50 a K over the last 2.2. To scare what at halfway was inconceivable.
Yeah.
It's just incredible. And yeah, I don't know what you make of it. I mean, it's just amazing.
Some of the interesting stats from that is that from the initial 5 kilometer splits that were around 20:41, 20.69 kilometers an hour, he eventually in the second half was running 21.7. And in the closing stages, Kipton's 35 to 40 kilometer split was 14:01, which was 42 seconds faster than Kipchoge's equivalent sprint, which is incredible, of the race. So that's not just a small difference. That's a significantly big difference over just 5K.
And the conditions were not really that good.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, like, normally we know, like, okay, coolish and rainy, a lot of water on the ground. We know, like, objectively, that's not good. But when you compare, for instance, the guy who finished just out of off the podium was a guy, Gebrselassie of Ethiopia, finished fourth, also halfway in 61:40, ended up running 2:05:45. So that's a 64-minute second half.
Mm.
And when you look at where Kipton was running splits from 30 to 35, and 35 to 40, Kipton ran 13:49, 14:01. Gebrselassie was hitting 15:20 and 15:54. So he lost almost 2 minutes every 5K in the last 10K. Yeah. And that was the guy who finished fourth. Like, yes. There were guys who didn't even make the top eight.
He's a class athlete on his own, right. Former Olympic champion over 10,000. Yeah.
So to put that time, like, that's how superior he was on the day. And that, it's mind-boggling, actually.
There's some classic splits here. They talk about the fact that that half marathon time, that 59:45, is only 13 seconds slower than Mo Farah's ratified British half marathon record.
Hmm. I think it might be faster than ours in South Africa.
I think it probably is.
Yeah, I was at the. There's been a series of middle distance races held in Greenpoint lately, and on, when was it, Monday night? There was an attempt at the SA record. And he ran 27:50 odd, which is, okay, decent going. But, like, this is not that far off that.
Yeah.
Between 30 and 40K of a marathon.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it is quite something.
Like. And so there's two things that I'd like to hear your sort of thoughts on. First of all, his age, 23 years of age, relatively new to the sport of distance running. Well, first, your comment on that. I mean, are we seeing young marathon runners?
Yeah, it's changed. Eh? Like, remember when I studied, the conventional wisdom was you did your time on the track, and as you ran the speed out of your legs, you made a shift to the marathon in your late 20s, and then you figured that it would take you three or four goes at the marathon to get your best time.
Correct.
And in fact, there was data on that showing that at that point, most athletes, and this was actually true of any level, would run their best marathon either in race 4 or 5. So they would get faster from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, and then they'd start getting slower again, 5, 6, 7, 8. Now you're seeing guys come in at early 20s, so 5 years before they used to. They don't take 4 or 5 races to figure it out. They're running 2:02s, 2:01s in this guy's case, almost right away. And okay, maybe this guy's actually going to get faster and run his fifth marathon. He'll run 2 hours and 20 seconds. And then there also seems to be greater longevity than before. Okay, Kipsang's career ended in disgrace with doping, but he'd run a dozen marathons and he was still competitive in Berlin. Kipchoge's done easily 12 now, more than that, I reckon.
Yeah.
So they have these very long careers and they start considerably younger.
Mm.
And so what used to be like an optimum Goldilocks zone, you know, not too old, not too young, now seems to be you can start whenever you want and you can go for as long as you're hungry and want to.
You see, the reason why it's I asked that question is that when you talk about the fact that conventional wisdom of being a track runner, you look at people like Haile Gebrselassie.
He
was another one of those guys who went from being a great track runner to, you know, being a great marathon runner. It doesn't make sense to me how a 23-year-old can literally come out of nowhere. Now, just giving you a bit of an idea, his first international race was in 2019, which was a 10K, where he finished second. Later that year, he competed in Sweden's half marathon, where he finished sixth. And his first five half marathons later, he took the first win at an event in 2019. And of course, in 2021, we've touched on the Valencia Marathon. But there's not a lot of history there in terms of the quality of his speed. It just seems so incredibly raw and untrained that it's like Pogacar-like in cycling terms.
It's definitely trained.
It's trained,
yes. It's definitely trained. And I mean, this is why, to refer to the conversation we had before this here main topic began, and I joked with you on a group chat on Sunday, like if he makes it to the start line in Berlin without becoming one of the latest Kenyan statistics on the doped list. No. That's the problem now. You have to recognize that when guys come out of nowhere and they're not in the testing pool,
it's worrying.
And they suddenly emerge, and we've seen a number of athletes, more on the women's side in Kenya, which is interesting. Mm. We've seen it before, so I wouldn't... Yeah, I'm always suspicious. You know, I'm a bit of a suspicious, cynical guy. But I think the other thing that's happening is they're like, why must I bother with a track? The Diamond League only caters to 5,000. That maybe this guy knows the best he's ever going to run a 5,000 is 12:56 and come sixth. But I can go straight to the marathon and make how much? Mid six figures? Dollars?
Yeah. You must have made a lot of money.
$500,000?
For sure. Horse records.
You make that just to start Berlin.
Mm.
Break a world record, sponsor bonuses, course record. He's going to make $2 million over the next 2 years.
Mm.
So why must I delay that? And so that's why they're going in so young, I think. And you see it, it's not new. Remember Sammy Wanjiru won the Olympic marathon at the age of 22 in 2008. And so you already, Martin Lal was straight into the marathon.
Yeah.
Didn't have a track background and so on. So you see Turgat, Gebrselassie, these guys, you say, okay, that's the way you do it, but not anymore.
Mm. Yeah, and do you think it's, in other words, I guess my question is, putting aside the fact that we have sometimes a cynical view of these things, it is feasible, because for me, it feels like such a stretch to come from relative obscurity to the big time with so little experience. Is it just pure, utter, out of this world talent that brings them into that space? Because you have to surely learn the pace, learn and understand your body, learn nutrition, all those sort of things. There's lots of things you have to know about running a marathon.
Well,
maybe not for him.
maybe not for a few. Look at the women's race. Sivan Hassan hadn't allegedly been practicing drinks. He had to at one point make a 90-degree turn to reach the drinks table because she almost overshot it. And she said she wasn't familiar with any of those patterns and so on. And I don't know.
She's got the class of the track. So for her, being a 10,000, 5,000-meter specialist and having performed in got all the medals at that level, coming to the marathon, she's got the credibility.
That's true. You've got some pedigree.
Yeah, you've got some pedigree.
Gebrselassie had the same. And remember, his first London marathon was a relative failure because he didn't drink and replace energy. So he got hypoglycemic. That was his story anyway.
Mm.
His telling of it. I've lost my train of thought.
Yeah.
Doping aside, which I'm sure contributes to some, not all, Kenyan dominance. The thing they got in Kenya now is like generations worth of acquired wisdom. And I think that they all train and communicate together. And there's so much intellectual capital about how to run marathons and how to prepare for them and so on, that I think they're on accelerated curves compared to what they would have been even 15, 20 years ago. Mm. So I think you could offer that in defense of how these guys enter the marathon at 202 level. There's no apprenticeship here. They're just straight in at that ability. And you know, it's... Okay, again, setting aside now the other darker, cynical side, I do think that they are so well prepared by the competitive nature of training in Kenya that they can come in and just run it as if it's what they're familiar with, you know? Mm.
I wonder if there's also an element, almost the Roger Bannister effect, where you've got a Kipchoge who did a manufactured sub 2 minute. They're seeing Kipchoge as a 37-year-old running 201 and running the world record. The mindset goes, well, okay, here's a 37-year-old Kenyan who can do this, so maybe going sub 201 is very possible.
Yeah.
Therefore, it opens up the floodgates of possibility.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that, remember, the sport's been recalibrated, A, by the shoes.
For sure. We'll talk a bit about that as well.
And B, by the target.
Yeah.
So in the absence of either, they probably wouldn't be running where they are, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they've got a target of 201. It was 2 years ago, 202, right? When was the first sub 202? It was Kipchoge running 201.30 something, right? That was probably before COVID.
Yeah, he did the
201.09 last year. So, but regardless, within the last 4 years, I think the target has moved a minute faster than it would have done. And then the shoes have allowed them to get really close to that target. I still maintain guys like Kipchoge are getting a couple minutes worth in a marathon. Maybe Kipton's the same.
Mm.
So now all of a sudden it's in reach, whereas before it was just a number.
Mm.
So I think a combination of those two things is definitely driving it.
Mm. And Evans Chebet, I mean, there are a lot of similarities between Evans Chebet. He, of course, won the Boston Marathon for the second year in the row this year. Very similar in terms of the fact that he's never raced on the track. He literally went from being right onto the road and racing the road. And, you know, he's competed in lots of international marathons. But he was another one of these relatively new generation of marathon runners who didn't do it the way we expected. So I guess there are multiple examples now. We've at least got two examples of the two top marathon runners in the world now, arguably, who are not from a track background and are defying and changing the way that we see marathon running.
Yeah, and then the guy they've displaced, and I mean, maybe it's premature to say displaced. Maybe Kipchoge comes back and maybe he wants to say, I'm going to line up in Berlin and defend my record against Kiptum and Chebet, because I would imagine, but maybe Berlin doesn't have the money to pay for all three. But that would be certainly the 1, 2, and 3 at the moment that you'd want to see, right?
Mm.
But Kipchoge, I remember, came from a track background. In fact, Kipchoge was probably the classic evolution of a distance run. He was a world champion at 5,000 in 2003, 20 years ago as a teenager. Yeah,
amazing.
And then made his debut in the marathon probably 10 years after that, and now has kept going in the marathon for another 10 years. So what's unusual about Kipchoge is the longevity on the back end, not necessarily on the age he started. So yeah, different patterns now. Women's is the same, man. None of those... Helen O'Berry and Hassan, okay, as I say, none of them, I've realized, the two winners are track athletes who've transitioned. But there are a lot of athletes now who have no track pedigree at all.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's clearly no longer a prerequisite.
Yeah.
You just go straight in and you run a marathon as if it's a 10K. You just figure it out in training, and then you go once, twice in the race, and you're golden.
One of the things I found quite interesting, I did an interview with one of our South African top runners, Gerda Steyn, just after the Olympics in 2021. And she is a very competent marathon runner, but she's more of an ultra distance runner. And she ran a sub 230, I think 225, I think it was. But one of the things that she had to ask herself at a point in the race was, do I go with the surge or do I hold on and make sure that I finish? And when I did the interview with her, I said, do you think that you get to a level in the sport where you have to risk failure to ultimately succeed at the max? So in other words, a guy like Kiptum, does he go into the race with the mindset of saying, I'm going to go as hard as I can, I might fail, but if I do succeed, I'm going to be absolutely outstanding? There's two mindsets there. One is, I want to finish, therefore I'm probably not going to push myself to the brink of disaster. And there's also the mindset of saying, well, if I don't do well, it's just I'll give it a go next time. You know, there's two mindsets which I find fascinating. And I'd love to be able to have a chat to people like Kiptum and say, like, what is your mindset going into this? Do you go in and run as hard as you can? Because he didn't have any intention of getting close to the world record.
No, you can tell that by the halfway split. Because if he's hungry for that, they'll hit halfway at 60-30.
Correct.
Yeah.
So he didn't have any intention. It just happened because he was racing.
Yeah. And that's why I say, I wonder if there's something in his psychology that makes him say, I'm not going to risk a fast first half. because he wants to finish super fast. But he'll have to if he wants. Well, he doesn't even have to. All he's just run the, all he's going to do is run the first half 20 seconds fast, well, 30, and then run the second half 10 seconds slower than he did, and he'll still get the world record.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's quite clear that they do race like that. I mean, you look at the halfway leaderboard in London, and okay, Kiptum's on it, Kemwara's on it, and Tola's on it, top three. But like now you got Amos Kipruto, Behane Legesse, Lille Gebrselassie, we just spoke about, he hang on for fourth. Kinder Atenor, Seifert Tura, Kenenisa Bekele, none of those guys on their leaderboard at the finish.
Yes.
None of them. So they've all thrown their chips in on one. Like they all said, red 13, go for it. And none of them won. They all went bust. So they do. It's very much just a go till you blow approach, I think.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the question. Is
maybe it's different. Someone like Gerda Steyn's not on massive appearance money, maybe none. So her best chance is I have to finish in the top 10, otherwise I'm leaving here with nothing. A lot of these guys, Bekele and so on, they made a paycheck before they started.
Yes.
So maybe they're willing to risk a bit
more. But she admits that for her to reach her potential as a marathon runner, she has to risk failure. She has to at some point. To get to some 220 point, you have to do that. You know?
It's tough because you've only got if you do that and bomb out, you'll make 30 Ks. So you could do three a year like that. If you do it and hang on to the finish, you've got two chances a year.
Yeah.
So it's a big risk. It's a massive risk to take. Yeah.
Just to give you an idea of the kind of times we're talking about, the Berlin race that Chebet made his debut at in 2016, and don't forget he has a bit of experience behind him, was 2:03:03, which nowadays is a relatively pedestrian time. But that was Berlin in 2016.
Then it was super quick because there was no shoe then.
Yeah, that was Kenenisa Bekele who won that race in 2:03:03.
I remember that.
So it shows the benefit of the shoe.
Exactly.
And then just touch briefly just on the performance of Sifan Hassan. I mean, absolutely amazing there. She apparently had to stop and stretch her hip.
The
commentators are saying, well, here's a good place to pull out here because there's a hotel here. This is where all the top athletes pull out. And next minute, she's dragging herself back towards that lead group.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a fait accompli by the time she got to the lead group because nobody's going to beat her in the sprint.
Yeah, and that's the interesting thing. You know, and as I was watching it, and this race was very similar to the Boston Marathon in the way that it finished. Obviously, Boston lacked an athlete stopping to stretch and the drama with the water tables and getting dropped and coming back. But you had the same pattern or the same concept at the end, which relates actually to the podcast we did two back on durability. And so I was watching it, thinking about that and thinking, okay, let me try and revise durability. If you said to those women on the start line, if you intercepted them on the start line, you said, ladies, this race is today going to be 2Ks long. Who's winning? 100% time Hassan, like by mile, by a lot. Remember, she was a world champion at 1500 and won silver at the last Olympics over that distance. She's like one of the fastest ever. If you tell them, ladies, it's 5K, who's winning? Hassan. 10K, Hassan. So everyone other than Hassan is really comfortable with any change in the race template. So the only chance any of those other athletes, Jepchircha and the Ethiopians have, is that they've got to say, okay, at some point, over the marathon distance, I'm 30 seconds faster than her, and then I'll beat her. But they didn't have it on Sunday. They just did not have it. Like, and you can see that in the times because they, unlike the men, were quite aggressive in the first half. 1:08:40 to halfway. So that's a 2:17:20. They finish up running 2:18:30. So they ran a fairly hefty positive split by these standards, right? But you look at the times. These are the split paces. So this is minutes per K for the last five 5K segments. 3:15, 3:13. That was the segment, the 3:13. It was a 16:03 5K. That's when Jepchirchir went to the front and they got a gap on Hassan. And it looked like she was gone. Then they go 3:19. She's back. Then they go 3:25. Now she's comfortable. And then they go 3:29, including her sprint. Their last 2K was so slow. By that stage, I just think the other three were done.
Yeah.
So then you end up concluding, like, how do you beat someone who could beat you over a short distance, who could beat you over 5, could beat you over 10, could beat you over 21. It's like she's almost unbeatable.
I guess the only chance that Peres Jepchirchir would have had is by literally digging into her fatigue resistance.
Exactly. So she's got to exploit that durability advantage because you're going to say, all right, at the start line, 5K. If you interrupted this race at 10K and you said, all right, ladies, two to go. Who's winning? Hassan. 21K? Who's winning? Hassan. The only chance Jepchirchir and Nazir Thiaban got is if you stop that race at 40, it had to be so fast that Hassan had nothing left or wasn't with them. And I think to her credit, Jepchirchir tried.
She did, yeah.
She ran that 3:13. And then you look what happened to her, 3:19, 3:25. They got slower and slower by 30 seconds every 5Ks. So,
I think they got demoralized once they saw Hassan on the back of the elite group. They were like,
they had a play and it didn't work, you know. Yeah. So then you say, well, the only way you beat her is Jepchirchir had to run 2:17:30.
Yeah.
And they tried, just didn't have it.
Yeah.
So, and then who's to say, before we know, Hassan, without a slight leg niggle, she's going to run 2:17:32.
Yeah.
So now you're going to run 2:16. And then there's only one or two women in the world.
Interesting to see if she goes back to the track.
That's her stated plan. She said that she didn't even train for this as a marathon.
Yes.
She said she largely kept her track training going and added some distance. And so her plan very much is, and I would imagine, remember, this is the athlete who won the 10 and the 5 in Tokyo and then tried to win the 15. And beaten there by Kipyegon, who is arguably the best 1500 meter runner ever in the sport. And if not for her, Hassan would be a triple, at the level of Zatopek in the 50s.
Still, as Chip Cheche and stuff, I would have been, I think it's a bit demoralizing when you hear that she hasn't trained specifically for it. It diminishes the achievement of the marathon and diminishes her achievement to some extent.
Well, it amplifies.
I wonder if she did train for the marathon specifically, would she be any faster?
No, maybe not.
I think tactically she could be, but could she time trial a world record? I don't know. It's always easy to say.
Like you'll be so much quicker. So it'll be. I would imagine she'll want to go to the Olympics on the track.
Yeah.
And then after that, do half a dozen marathons.
Yeah.
And maybe give it a proper go, and then she'll be in her 30s and so on. I mean, and again, just for the sake of disclosure for listeners, I'm not all that trusting of Hassan. She's got the associations with Salazar from the past, and there've always been a few question marks about her and the coaching and so on. Obviously, she's not with him anymore. He's not allowed to coach. But again, that's always the fine print here, right?
Yeah.
But it's really hard to see how you beat her unless you run top two or three time in history.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the final sort of edition of ideas here around the marathons, and I was taking a look at just searching for some information around the marathon shoe wars about Nike versus Adidas, and On, of course, Helena Berry running with On shoes in Boston, winning those, of course, massive celebrations there, running in a pair of prototypes, which was interesting because I wasn't sure that was allowed.
I thought the same actually when I heard that. It can't be.
It can't be a prototype because they need to be available.
Yeah,
to the
that
public,
was the policy from the IAAF, was World Athletics rather.
So I thought.
I would maybe attribute that to a misunderstanding or miscommunication by the commentator.
You should be able to buy Helena Berry shoes in the shops.
Yeah.
That's the rule by World Athletics.
That's the way I understood it.
Yeah. We should just look and see what bottle she was using. But what was interesting is that Sean Ingle, our favorite journalist from The Guardian, wrote a very nice little piece around this whole story about the shoe wars. And he's talking back in 2016 when Nike sort of first released their first of their super shoes. It was, Nike dominated. They took 31 of the 36 podiums in the 6 marathon majors. But now, over the last couple of weekends with Boston and London, Monday's Boston Marathon, where athletes wearing their Adidas Adios Pro 3 took the top 4 places in the men's race. And of course, we just talked about Helena Berry using the prototype, according to this story, of that Swiss brand to win the women's event. So there is a bit of a change. And then Jeff Burns, who we've interviewed in this podcast before, a biomechanics expert and sports physiologist who works for the US Olympic and Paralympic Committee, and he said that Nike is no longer the definitive outright leader. I've tested a lot of shoe brands and foams, and the running economy benefits are now pretty similar, which I guess to some extent is good news for the sport because we are no longer in a position where there is one brand outdoing another on the technology side. Yeah, what we see is probably a leveler playing field.
Yes, it's certainly leveler. I'm not, and I mean, to his credit, Jeff's not saying it's level. He's saying it's more level, right? Was the quote leveler.
Yeah.
Or closer to being.
There's no definitive outright leader.
Okay, so that's how a scientist says inconclusive. Because
from one scientist to another.
I'm still not convinced that other companies would catch up to what is Nike's third gen shoe with their first. Like the big breakthrough comes in one. then it's incremental into and small incremental, and eventually you get diminishing returns and you'll plateau the benefit, right? So, of course, Adidas can buy that Nike shoe, they can cut it up and effectively reverse engineer it like On would do, like ASICS would do.
Mm.
But I still think the first mover advantage probably puts Nike a tiny bit ahead, but it's no longer definitive.
Mm.
And that is good news. Like, wasn't the stat in that article 31 out of 36 back in 2019?
Yeah, 31 out of 36 podium places in the six majors.
That's six podium spots if you think men and women, three each. Yeah, and like only 5 out of 36 went to anything other than a Nike shoe. Now, okay, Boston was covered by Adi Nike. The women's race had On as the top, and the two Ethiopians, I think, are usually Nike, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
So, Adidas did very well in Boston. Boston. And
In London, it was a Nike event.
Yes.
Effectively, right?
For sure.
Yeah, so we're better off. I still think... Okay, so it's recalibrated, like we mentioned a few minutes back. My biggest concern still, and it's just something that's now normal, is that there are definitely athletes who get more than others.
Mm. In terms of how they respond to the shoe.
Yeah, as individuals. Right. Like, there are guys, and in fact, in that article, maybe you'll read that quote from Chris Thompson in a moment, talking about the average, but some people get a lot, other people very little. Kipton might be a 3-4% guy, in which case he's getting 4 minutes in a marathon. The guy came third.
So when he says 3-4% guy, in other words, he's a what did you call it when they react?
Super responder.
Yeah. There we go.
And then you'll get non-responders.
Mm.
And that's definitely the case. Like, if you look at the...
I've run those shoes and I'm certainly not a responder at all. No faster than I was in the normal shoes.
I think you have to load them at a certain rate, which requires running at a certain speed. When I run in them, you can feel the difference,
but it makes no difference to my speed.
I haven't run them enough yet. I've got a pair of the Adidas ones, but I've not run in them enough. And so it's possible that some athletes in London got 1% and one or two got 3 or 4%. Mm. So that's a 3% difference as a function of the shoes. So one of the grand cool experiments would be if every athlete had to put shoes on in the morning, chosen out of a pile randomly. And if you could run in a parallel universe, the same race in different shoes, 5 different times, and see what the variance is in a guy's times. Maybe Kipton's a 2:03 guy. And Gebre Selassie's a 2:01 guy if they swapped shoes. And that's the problem. Like, as I said before, I never watch a tennis match thinking if Alcaraz and Djokovic just swapped rackets, this game would go differently.
Yeah.
Whereas, unfortunately, with the shoes, I still do.
Because
I don't know who's responding and who's not to different ones. And that's why I think Jeff on Twitter has advised that if he was an elite athlete, he'd buy 5 or 6 and he'd do a battery of testing over a week, and he'd figure out which one gave him the best responses, because the effect is literally large enough that one shoe might be worth minutes to you and not another one.
Tricky when your sponsors dictate you with a certain shoe.
There was a case study. One of the women had a deal with Saucony. I remember reading this in Outside magazine, and then went to a lab and was tested in Sauconys, the Nike, the Adidas, the ASICS, to reassure herself that she wasn't starting at a disadvantage. And I think in the end, she was equal enough that she was satisfied that this was going to be okay for her.
Mm.
But it's quite clear from some of the other studies that you get athletes who get nothing from some shoes and a lot from others.
Mm.
So it's part of it. It's part of the talent ID mix now.
Yeah.
That's the problem. So,
yeah.
But this is now, at least it's not the talking point.
No. It's definitely quelled down.
But it confounds it. I mean, you say, okay, 42-year-old runs 2. What was the Thompson quote? You wanted to talk about the aging?
Yeah, so the gentleman by the name of British athlete Chris Thompson, who is 42, he said in 2014 he ran a 2:11, and he turned out that he was, I think, 10th actually at London this year. At the age of 42, ran 2:11:50. So he talks, and he was quoted in the story saying, there's no shying away from it. Super shoes have a huge impact on performance. I ran 2:11 and it is still to this day the most emotional, painful, horrible, excruciating I ever did. But then again, he ran that 2:11:50, you know, literally 7 years later. So he's got no business running that sort of speed at 42, but there he is doing it, and he completely gives a credit to the shoes to some extent.
Yeah, he does. He says, on average, I reckon worth 4 minutes for a top male in a marathon.
Mm.
Talks about the benefit is acute. And then he also says they also allow you to recover quicker in training. I used to run 120 miles a week. I've heard of some doing 160 to 170 miles. Look, it's weird that he doesn't say, I now do 160 to 170. Maybe he's doing 140 now.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can train more.
That's also interesting because there's been some discussion about whether you can use those super shoes in training because they would have more of an impact. But he's saying you can.
Yeah, and quite clearly. I think a lot of the athletes are. I remember hearing that very early on. They've got a very short lifespan. I think the carbon fiber plate loses whatever it is. Mm. One of the researchers said it turns into a frying pan after about a month.
Okay.
Like it's just a dead, it's like a dead spring, you know? So this was his words.
It's an expensive dead spring because they're not cheap.
Yeah, so this is a sponsored. This is the sponsored 50 athletes in the world who are doing that.
Yeah,
but there was some paper, some research published very early on in the months leading up to COVID at a conference in the US where rating of perceived exertion and muscle soreness were all lower when you did a training session in these shoes compared to what was then normal back then. Mm. So, and that's sometimes the limiting thing. You know, maybe it's 10% more training. 0.5% better performance, 1%. It's all adding up, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, we've just recalibrated it, and it's almost no point complaining anymore. No. It is what it is. It's just a shame that it is how
we can't look at marathon times of 2016 and compare them to now because we have to.
No, there's this massive confounder, for sure. You know? Yeah. And that's the problem.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Well, we hope we've wrapped up the changes, the Kipchoge 2.0, which people are calling it on Twitter and some of the articles I've read. We look forward to seeing what happens with Calvin Kiptum and people like Evans Chebet in the next couple of years and see whether they do end up breaking records and beating the great Eliud Kipchoge. Let us know what you think, of course. We're on Twitter on SportsSciPod. And, of course, our Patreon page is patreon.com and then / Science of Sport podcast, where you can support us but also get involved in the many discussions which we have on those platforms. But for now, it's goodbye.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsSciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.